Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, America. You're tuned to a Just Cause Coast to Coast. I'm Sam Thurman, joined by Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez. A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. How you guys doing tonight?
Doing good.
All right. You know, we had a very, very compelling show last Thursday night and also this past Tuesday night. But, you know, last Thursday we had on the show, who was it? Anthony Graves. He was our exoneree moment. And along with Anthony was his attorney, Nicole Caceres, and you know, that was a very emotional show. And Anthony spent 18 years on death row in Texas, and he got exonerated. And you know, he's been making the circuit, and we were honored to have him on the show. He was on Katie Couric earlier this week. Did you guys see that? Or did you hear about that?
I heard about it. Yes, absolutely.
I knew he was supposed to be on there too.
While he was being interviewed.
Yeah. And then this past Tuesday, we had on our show Lamont Banks. He is an exoneree out of Colorado. And Lamont is here in the studio again with us this evening. And we'll be bringing him on within the about the next half hour or so. We're just going to take care of a couple of business items and do a recap of some of the things associated with the IRP6. And talk a few things about what's in the news with regard to judicial injustice and just, you know, bring folks up to speed. Folks, if you'd like to call in tonight, you can call in at 347-205-9620. 347-205-9620. And as we talk about the IRP6 case, you can go to www.a-justcause.com. Again, that's www.a-justcause.com, or you can go to www.freetheirp6, that's the number 6, .org. Again, www.freetheirp6.org. Got to throw this disclaimer in there. Cliff and I and Ethel are not attorneys, and a Just Cause Coast to Coast is not a program that provides legal advice. The opinions that are expressed by the callers, the guests, are not necessarily those of a Just Cause Coast to Coast. So we would ask that you would contact your legal professionals for specific legal needs. We want to thank you for joining our program this evening. You will gain a lot of insight into things that can go wrong in the judicial process and things that we have experienced as regard in dealing with the IRP6 case. That being said, Cliff, what's going on with the IRP6 right now?
Well, we got writ of mandamus was written, the motion put in by the appellate attorney, and it's amazing when you look at how because the court came back, they said, oh, it's a frivolous claim to, I mean, the writ of mandamus is to request information from the judge, from the court, that wasn't available to the defendants previously. And we found out about the over 200 pages of missing transcripts that the judge admits to, the court reporter admits to, you know, that a Just Cause is suing the court reporter for. And, you know, found out recently that it was over 200 pages and put that request in for the writ of mandamus, and the courts came back and denied it. And it's just amazing how they can say, you know, they denied it as a frivolous claim. And how do you say that it's frivolous that a group of defendants would be requesting the transcript from their case so that they can put on a proper appeal? It's very troubling, very disheartening, but, you know, we continue to fight it.
And, you know, we're approaching that from a couple of different angles right now. You mentioned the appellate attorney. That's Gwendolyn Solomon. She's the attorney for the IRP6. And so she's submitted that writ of mandamus. It came back denied. Mm-hmm. She's taking it to the next level. As a Just Cause, we are filing a lawsuit against Darlene Martinez, who is a court reporter in the federal court in the 10th District in Denver, who was instrumental in omitting those pages and working with the federal judge, Christine Arguello. And working on our behalf is the attorney out of Los Angeles, and that is Mark Garagos. And he joined forces with Cornell Johnson out of Denver. And so, Cliff, what's going on there? What do we kind of see on the horizon?
Yeah, we sat down last week with Mark Garagos out there in L.A., you know, as we took the trip and went to be on Mother Love show, which was a great experience. Sat down face-to-face with Tony Breedlove as well. And, you know, Mark Garagos, his strategy is – It's to be commended. It's to be admired. Mm-hmm. You know, you look at this guy and you see why he is one of the who's who as far as defense attorneys. And you know, it lays out basically that the government doesn't have a leg to stand on with this. I mean, they're coming from these different positions of, you know, they're protecting Darlene Martinez, the court reporter. They pulled her under the federal umbrella. They're representing her in a civil case. I mean, she was contracted out as an independent contractor to provide a just cause with the entire transcript. She didn't provide that. We sued her, and now the same government agency, the U.S. Attorney's Office up in Denver, Colorado, run by U.S. Attorney John Walsh, is coming to her rescue. You know, you and me, they wouldn't do it. They would not represent us for anything. But her, for some reason, they're trying to cover something up. They're trying to protect the judge. Whatever the reason may be, they've taken her under their wings. And but Mark Garagos is going after them, and we're confident that what he's doing is the right direction to take, and we're sure that it will be successful.
I tell you what, when Mark Garagos is done, Darlene Martinez will learn not to hide nothing else.
And hey, folks, you're listening to A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. If you'd like to call into the program tonight, you can call in at 347-205-9620. Now, Cliff, as far as a little bit of high-level background for those who are not familiar with the IRP 6 case, you know, we've all often stated that the IRP 6 case is a case study for us. You know, we're going to talk about a lot of different things. We're going to bring up a couple of other items here shortly. But there's so many egregious acts that occurred in this case that, you know, it makes for a perfect case study. And, you know, it helps us as far as getting the word out about the IRP 6, because, you know, our ultimate goal is to get them exonerated and then help others as well. And, you know, before you go there, Cliff, I just want to say, you know, shout out to Scott Osborne, who's making this hour possible for Just Cause Coast to Coast and contending for Truth Radio, and their efforts to get Don Miller exonerated.
Absolutely.
So, you know, folks need to go on to Blog Talk Radio and support Scott and Steve and those guys as they talk about Don Miller, because that's a case as well where, you know, Don
sure
has been
is.
In prison now, what, 14 years or something like that?
Yeah.
And that case is just it's almost as crazy as this one.
That's
but,
right.
You know, we haven't run across one that yet that can contend with the IRP 6 case.
Exactly.
So anyway, you know, Scott, thanks. We know you're out there listening from Contending for Truth Radio. And so, Cliff, give us a highlight of or the high-level overview. I'll get it out there in a second. A high-level overview of the IRP 6 case.
Yeah, you know, you look at some of these cases, like, you know, Free Don Miller and the just everything that happens in them. And when you look at the IRP 6 case and the reason that we're using it as a case study is because of how many crazy things went wrong during this case. And the IRP 6 were six executives in a small business called IRP Solutions. And IRP Solutions was raided by the FBI for allegedly scamming staffing companies. But what really happened is that the company was responding to requests from the government to modify their flagship software called SILC, Case Investigative Lifecycle. And they got behind on paying invoices. And in order to modify their software, IRP had to use temporary staffing companies that specialize in technology professionals. So they brought these temps on board to work on the software. But when IRP didn't close business as quickly as it thought, that's when invoices went delinquent and allegations of wrongdoing came up. And so the IRP 6 case is a corporate debt collection case that got criminalized
absolutely
by an overzealous FBI agent and an overempowered assistant U.S. attorney. And this FBI special agent, John Smith, you know, he orchestrated a raid on IRP. He got a search warrant that stated in so many words that IRP was a front company. And then Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch, he then prosecuted the case, although there was evidence and expert witnesses that would substantiate the legitimacy of IRP Solutions as a business. And then the federal judge, Christine Arguello, who presided over the case, she didn't even give IRP 6 any reasonable consideration or benefit of the doubt during the trial. And in fact, you know, as we mentioned before, there are transcripts missing that would show critical rights that were violated during the course of this trial. And that's just one of the issues that the IRP 6 have on appeal.
And you know, a just cause was set up as a result of the IRP 6 case initially.
Right.
And the IRP 6 were instrumental in setting up a just cause. So, you know, folks can go out to www.a-justcause.com and see what our mission statement is and our vision. But basically, we're fighting this thing as far as, you know, when they go in and try and criminalize mm-hmm. things that people are conducting their normal day-to-day business, which is what IRP was doing. You have the CEO of a staffing company in Denver, mm-hmm. who is Andrew Alberelli. He was going to testify in their case as an expert witness, and the prosecution objected. The judge allowed the objection.
Right.
So they didn't even get a chance to hear from Mr. Alberelli as to the fact that IRP, the way they were conducting business, mm-hmm. was legitimate. You had two grand juries. The first grand jury said this is a debt collection case.
Right.
Well, you have Assistant U.S. Attorney Matthew Kirsch comes back, convenes a second grand jury with one witness being an FBI agent, and he gets an indictment. And then, you know, the list just goes on and on as far as all the other stuff that happened in this case. You got a situation where the speedy trial.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, folks need to go out to FreeTheIRP6.org and read about this. Ethel, you were trying to chime in there?
I was just thinking when Cliff was talking about so many things that went wrong in this case. These are not things that went wrong. These are things that were deliberately done wrong.
Exactly.
In this case. So
Excellent point.
I just need to clear that up, you know, so people will understand. Things don't just go wrong. You know, somebody makes a conscious effort to make sure that these things are done wrong.
And, you know, you're right in the sense that, and oftentimes we talk about it from the standpoint that if the system was allowed to run its course the way it is designed to,
right,
and the way we think it should,
mm-hmm.
we wouldn't even be sitting here today
absolutely.
Talking about this.
Absolutely.
I mean, even if you go back to the search warrant and when you have Special Agent John Smith getting a search warrant
right.
under the auspice that IRP was a front organization and saying that they're purportedly developing software,
mm-hmm.
even though he knew already that IRP was a legitimate business. And I mean, there was no justification at all for a search warrant.
Exactly.
So even right from the point in 2005 when the business was raided,
mm-hmm.
you know, that should have never even occurred.
And when we talked to our attorney friend in New York, he said that the fact that the software existed, just that fact alone brings to light the entire issue of this case is that if what's on the table, the premise of the investigation, the premise of the raid, all these things is that you're supposed to be running this front company.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have a product. You're just trying to scam somebody. Well,
mm-hmm.
the fact that you have a product says that I'm not running a scam. I have a product. I'm marketing it. I went into debt marketing my product. That is normal business operations. That is how business is done in America. But then you have the assistant U.S. attorney, you know, and all these other people, this web of friends that called in favors to get these people to, you know, to get an indictment. And when you look at, you know, Sam, you were saying how when the system goes the way that it's supposed to. Well, when you even look at the fact that even when the FBI was contacted
mm-hmm.
about this, that they even said it was a debt collection.
Exactly. And that was after the raid.
That was after
yeah.
the raid. That was after they put on their whole investigation and they said, oh, we need to go get these people. And, of course, John Smith brought up the frivolous claim of a front organization
mm-hmm.
to get his search
mm-hmm.
warrant. But
mm-hmm.
then when you go to the FBI and the FBI says, well, really, this is something that you should take up in debt collection, you know, court. And then to have them continue to press on, and even with Matthew Kirsch, you know, with two great perfect, get somebody, the FBI agent, to be the only witness and get this indicted.
That's crazy. This is the Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. callers. You can call in at 347-205-9620, 347-205-9620. Later in the program, we're going to have Colorado exoneree Lamont Banks. Don't go anywhere. Stay right there. We'll be right back after this.
My name is Elizabeth. Today, I'm going to talk to you about the rules of Halloween safety. Rule number one, never trick or treat without your mommy or daddy, because you can get kidnapped or lost forever. Rule number two, never ring a doorbell or go into a stranger's house without my mommy or daddy. Rule number three, always be careful when you're crossing the street or else, boom, squished by a big giant car. Rule number four, it is never okay to throw eggs or shaving cream. Rule number five, make sure your costume is flame retardant or you can catch on fire and burn. Rule number six, make sure to carry a flashlight or a glow stick. Rule number seven, never eat candy that is opened or unwrapped because it might be poison. I hope you enjoyed all of my rules of Halloween safety. Happy Halloween. Goodbye.
When does it stop being partly cloudy and start being partly sunny? Why is the word abbreviation so long? Are English muffins just muffins in England? Why is it called a washing line and not a drying line? Do fish get thirsty? If ghosts can walk through doors, why don't they fall through floors? Do you yawn when you sleep? If prunes are dried plums, how do they make prune juice? Why do doctors leave the room when you change? They're going to see you naked anyway. Do bald chefs wear hairnets? How much deeper would the ocean be if all the sponges were taken out? Do you believe someone who says they're a chronic liar? Why is sandwich bread square and sandwich meat round? Life's full of hard questions. Ask one more. You might just save a life.
Welcome back to the program. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. I'm Sam Thurman, your host, along with Cliff Stewart and Ethel Lopez. And joining us in the studio a little bit later will be Lamont Banks, as we talk about, we'll highlight him and focus on Mr. Banks during our exoneree moment. Before the break, we were talking about the IRP 6 case. Folks, if you'd like to call in, the number is 347-205-9620, 347-205-9620. And so I guess, to wrap up on the IRP6 highlights, we have the writ of mandamus where Attorney Gwendolyn Solomon is taking that to the next level. One thing I will say about that as well, and we have a press release that's going to be coming out talking about it, the IRP6 are actually speaking out on their own behalf regarding the denial of that writ of mandamus. And so be on the lookout for that press release. It will be posted on the websites, and then it will also be excerpts of their statements will be included in the press release that will be coming out. So in the next few minutes, let's talk about some things that might be in the news. So, Ethel, I know you found this one real interesting story that is just, it's crazy. I mean, when we talk about bringing awareness about the things that can go wrong in the judicial system, let's talk about that story about solitary confinement and the invisible scars.
Yeah, I actually really kind of found that very interesting, talking about solitary confinement. This gentleman, I believe his name is Five Omar Molem Ak, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. But anyway, he was talking about, you know, the time that he spent in solitary confinement, and it was just for really trivial violations, you know, just little things. And he was saying that, you know, it's time that people looked at this kind of abuse as torture.
Exactly.
You know, and it's like, what else could you call it other than torture? And he was talking about, you know, oftentimes, and he had been in there for all these little trivial things for a period of over 5 years. Okay, he had a 9-year prison sentence, but over 5 years that he spent in and out of solitary confinement. And he's talking about how it made him feel like he was just invisible, you know, and it's something that he never ever thought that he would experience. You know, he spent, I think it said a total of 2,054 days in solitary and other forms of isolated confinement. And a short time after he was put in there, he talked about how his senses began to diminish, you know, and the cells, and how they have the steel doors, and most of them don't even have windows, you know, and talked about what he did to fight, like, the blankness. And he talked about counting the bricks on the wall.
And, you know, Ethel, when I look at the printout of this article, and people can go to theguardian.com and see this article.
Yeah.
Again, that's theguardian.com. And the photo that they have here is a long corridor that looks like about the size of 2 football fields.
Yeah, it does.
And nothing but concrete.
Nothing.
It's like concrete ceiling, concrete walls, and concrete floor.
That's
And as we, you know, when we were talking to Anthony Graves last week, you know, and you know, there are a lot of health issues and everything that comes along with that. And, you know, during our pre-show sit-down, you know, Mr. Banks was sharing some of that with us as well, and so we'll be getting into that when we talk to him. But, you know, Ethel, one of the things that stood out to me when you about this particular article, too, you know, tell the story about the apple. I mean, that's crazy.
You know, he was saying one day that he ate an entire apple, and how he included the core of the apple because he was starving for a lack of nutrition. And he said that he even received a ticket for eating the core. And this was because they said the apple seed contains arsenic, okay, which is spelled out supposedly in the prison handbooks. He said the next time that he received the apple, he was so scared he didn't want to get another ticket. He simply left it on the tray and didn't eat it. You know, he said.
And so they gave him a write-up for that.
He got a write-up for that. The man couldn't win for losing. What was he supposed to do?
And when you look at, you know, what I found really interesting about this article and how he spells out, when you look at the sentences that are given to inmates, that their sentence is either you know, is given by the judge based on their conviction of a jury. And he spells out that neither a judge nor a jury of his peers handed down the sentence to him about being put in solitary confinement.
Right.
He was saying that it was completely determined by the prison staff, and these people don't have any, you know, they don't have any background on who you are. They don't have any history of your case, or if you're violent, or you committed a white collar crime, or anything like that. But yet they're handing down, you're already doing the sentence of spending time in prison.
That's right.
And they hand down another sentence to say confine you in a box. And he calls it, you know, a bathroom size room. And when you think about a room that's that small and being put in, I think Anthony Graves was the one who said, you know, it's like the size of a parking space.
I think that came out during the Herman Wallace,
right, from
the Angola 3, that it's basically confined to a parking space.
And, you know, the people who put you in there, do they know your medical background? Mm-hmm. They don't know if you're claustrophobic. They don't know your psychological state of mind or anything like that. And I thought that very interesting that, you know, we always say, well, you know, the judge hands down the sentence and supposedly it's supposed to be fair. But, well, we all know what that means. But then you have the prison staff just take it upon themselves to say, we're going to put you in a hole for 23 hours a day, and we're going to leave you in there for as long as we see fit. And, you know, sometimes we've heard about them, you know, just forgetting about people.
Or trying to set people up.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, when even look at our own, you know, the Iron P6.
Exactly.
And, you know, they've tried to set them up. And,
we
heard the story recently of David Banks
mm-hmm.
where, you know, they tried to say that he had alcoholic beverages in his bottle in his room.
Right.
Where someone else had done that. And then even on that,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we always use the term that you're not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater, But, you know, you have some folks who are in the prison system who really care.
Right.
But then you have others who are there. I don't know if it's because they can't find something else to do.
Right.
But they find it to be their life's
their ambition.
To put their thumb on somebody else.
That's it.
And to try and set people up.
And you know what, too? When this man was talking about, you know, prison is supposed to take away your freedom. But he said, you know, but solitary doesn't just confine your body. It kills your soul. You know, that is some stuff right there. That is deep. It kills your soul.
And that's what they're after. They're saying we don't want to just, you know, punish you for your crime, rehabilitate you so you can go back to society when you're finished with your time. We want to destroy your persona, your personality. We want to break who you are.
That's it.
And that's not what it's supposed to be about. It's supposed to be a place where a person can be rehabilitated.
Yeah.
Where they can show penitence. They can say, okay, I'm going to pay my debt to society. And then when I'm finished with it, I'm finished. But they put you in there, and they put you under these cruel, unusual conditions, locking you in a box for, you know, 5 years straight. That's amazing.
Cliff. I mean, even, you know, what the man says, you know, he said, even though I'm out of prison, he still suffers with major psychological consequences from the years of isolation. You know, he has irreparable memory damage. He can hardly sleep. He's got a short temper. He don't even like people to touch him. He can't listen to music or watch TV. This is ridiculous.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, when I'm sitting here looking at David Banks' write-up regard to the writ of mandamus, and, you know, he makes some good points as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like you were just saying, you and Cliff talking about the fact that when they put him in prison, you know, they are really trying to – they disrespect them.
Yeah.
And they're trying to strip everything down that makes them who they are.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and I'm reading, you know, from David's excerpt here, and he's saying that, you know, it seems to be that folks are intentionally disrespecting them and disrespecting, you know, the rights.
Right.
You know, if you still have some rights,
mm-hmm.
you know, as long as you're going through the appellate process and then even after that,
exactly.
you know, because of the fact that if you know without a shadow of a doubt
mm-hmm.
that you didn't do anything and that you're innocent, then you're going to walk through life under the premise that I still have rights. And, you know, some of the things that David is talking about here is that, you know, the appellate judges and other judges that are in the district seemingly not opening their eyes to the fact that there have been serious constitutional violations as far as the rights of the IRP6.
That's
and
right.
as long as those violations have occurred, then your rights should still be respected.
Exactly.
And so those are the kind of things they're fighting for, and we as a just cause are fighting for on their behalf because of the fact that, you know, no one should cover up acts of someone else just because, you know, I'm a judge, you're a judge, and, you know, I work in the federal court system, you work in the federal court system.
Mm-hmm.
I screwed up,
mm-hmm.
and now you're going to cover me screwing up even at the expense of someone else's rights.
Absolutely.
That is not the way it's supposed to be. And, you know, we as a just cause, we're going to continue to push for the IRP6. We're going to continue to push for other people that are out there. Callers, you can call in at 347-205-9620,
mm-hmm.
347-205-9620. When we come back, we're going to be joined in the studio by Lamont Banks. He is an exoneree from Colorado Springs, Colorado, and we're going to hear his story. You don't want to move. This is going to be a compelling segment. We're pretty much going to devote a majority of the rest of the program to Mr. Banks. I'm Sam Thurman, your host. We'll be right back after this.
Today, innocent Americans are standing trial for crimes they didn't commit. Today, innocent Americans are writing for help from a prison cell. Today, hundreds of Americans have been exonerated of crimes they didn't commit. Researchers believe that at least 40,000 innocent Americans still sit behind bars. For them, the answers do not come easy. A Just Cause seeks true balance and accountability in the judicial process, ensuring that innocent men and women are not convicted and sentenced to prison for trivial, obscure acts that are otherwise not seen as crimes. For more information on how A Just Cause may help you or how you can get involved to stop overcriminalization of innocent Americans, visit www.a-justcause.com or call 855-529-4252. That's 855-529-4252.
Just Cause Coast to Coast, a song performed by Tiffany Stewart and written by Cole Stewart. Tiffany Stewart is the daughter of one of the IRP6, the daughter of Clinton Stewart, and Cole Stewart is the son of our co-host, Cliff Stewart. You're tuned to A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Joining us in the studio this evening is Lamont Banks. And Mr. Banks was exonerated in the state of Colorado. He's going to share his story with us. And Ethel, you had another point you wanted to make briefly before we went into that break.
You know, as I was thinking back, I remember, you know, our church used to volunteer in Florence at the prison. And I remember our pastor saying to us that one of the guards had said to her that, you know, these guys are these guys are animals, and you know, you have to treat them like that. And my thing to that is, if you have guards in the prison with that type of mentality, well, my God, that's exactly how they're going to treat these people.
Exactly. And, you know, Ethel, on that point, we Cliff and I were part of that team that used to go there.
That's right.
And
that's
we
right.
did that for about 5 years.
Yes.
And you know what you found out is that, and the pastor put it pretty plainly from the standpoint that there are people there, and we know for sure now there are people in prison that shouldn't be there.
Absolutely.
And then there are those who are there who should be there.
Yeah, yeah.
But the ones, they basically give you back what you give them.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
And they realized that when our team came in there to do praise and worship and the pastor came to preach,
right.
that we didn't disrespect them.
That's right.
And we didn't expect to be disrespected.
That's right.
But you know what resulted in that, Ethel? It was the fact that that service, mm-hmm. when we went, mm-hmm. ended up being one of the largest services in a maximum security prison.
Absolutely.
And you had black, white, Latino, Indian. You had every ethnic group to come into that chapel. They said that doesn't happen.
You know.
I mean, the different groups are so segmented in prison. So, you know, and they wonder mm-hmm. why prisoners lash out. Because of the fact, if you're working in that system and your mentality is
Absolutely.
That, well, you know, these are animals, you have to treat them that way.
Uh-huh.
No, you're going to treat them or they're going to act the way you treat them. It's just like if you have a pet.
Okay.
You know, and you disrespect your pet or you don't feed your cat or your dog or whatever, they're going to find another home.
Thank you.
Or they're going to rebel against you or something.
That's exactly right.
And what you look at is that, you know, Even though, like you say, some of these prisoners, they've committed crime and they're there and they realize that they're there for what they've done,
mm-hmm.
all they're looking for is respect.
Yeah.
And that's what we found is that if you respect a person,
mm-hmm.
then you'll get respect back, you know, for the most part. And the guards and the staff and the whole prison complex is about how much we can oppress you, how
That's right.
hard
yeah.
we can hold you down,
yeah.
how much we can treat you like an animal.
Yeah.
And then when you respond like one,
right.
then they say, see, we told you they're animals. Well, if you put me on a leash,
right.
if you lock me in a cage, if you
the shackles and chains.
Yeah,
right.
If you put me in shackles and chains and then you beat me while I'm handcuffed
yeah.
and you totally mistreat me, then what do you expect for me to do?
Right, right. But and you know what too, and I won't say, you know, even that all of the guards are, you know, have that same mentality and so forth.
Right.
But you find the majority they do. You know, even we there are even some decent ones that, you know, are at Florence at the camp down
That's
there
right.
where the IRP 6 are.
That's right.
You know, and I really have to just give, you know, a shout out to them because some of them are really, really nice, decent people.
Well, and they, but the know, thing is, you know, they realize that the IRP 6 are innocent
absolutely,
men.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And so, you know, when you see that, even some of the prisoners who
right.
are there who admit that, hey, I'm supposed to be here.
Right.
But they look at the IRP 6 and they say, why are you here?
And then you got some that are complete jackasses. And they're going to stay jackasses for the rest of their lives because that's how they're treating people.
That is absolutely
true. You know what
true. I'm saying? That's absolutely true. Callers, you can call in at 347-205-9620. 347-205-9620. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Some of the things we were just talking about as far as the inhumane acts and inhumane conditions. You know, Mr. Banks, he's going to share with us firsthand his story. Lamont, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a privilege.
And we appreciate you taking time out of your evening to be here in the studio with us.
Yeah.
Mr. Banks is being our honoree as far as an exoneree
yeah.
for this week. And so, you know, I think it's important for people to hear firsthand some of the things that occur. You know, we had an emotional show on Tuesday
mm-hmm.
When you joined us, and those who didn't tune in then, if you're just tuning in and you're going to hear some things, you know, I'm going to go on and say it. It can be disturbing.
Yeah.
And I'm an emotional person. And so I have to sit here and fight back, you know, getting too overly emotional about it. But, you know, if you got any warm blood running through your veins, and if you're human at all and have a heart at all, you're going to feel something.
Oh, yeah.
So, Lamont, you, you know, in your profile, it talks about here that, you know, you were falsely accused of a horrific crime that you never committed. Tell us about that story and how it got started.
Well, back in 2005, I was actually an acquaintance with a young lady, and she had two children, basically, that I kind of sort of raised, if you will, for, you know, several years, actually, at least probably 5 years. And
wow.
Things started getting out of hand. One of the older teenagers started getting really rebellious and doing a lot of crazy things. And you know, you're saying that you can't do that. This is just way outside the scope of things. And unfortunately, she began to plot and to scheme of a way to get rid of me, because you know, her mother didn't do a lot of challenging at times, not on the level necessarily that I did. And again, this isn't my blood daughter or anything like that. I don't have any children, but it was a ready type situation.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, she started to seek out, do things around the house that just were unconventional.
Right.
Things that just didn't make a lot of sense. And she began to act out.
Right.
Do a lot of things. There were times that she would parade around the house and little nothing.
Right.
That we would tell her, hey, you know, you need to really put something on. I got, you know, friends coming over, and you just that loose
right.
mentality.
Right.
It was just really, really bad. And anyway, as things progressively got worse, and I was called in to deal with school issues and a lot of issues that were going on, you could feel the hate at a level that you couldn't believe. But you look over that. You still never can see anything going really to the level that it went.
So you were basically fulfilling the role as a father figure in this young girl's life.
Absolutely.
To the extent that
was.
Right,
that, yeah.
right.
Right. And it was very, very close to the younger one. Just a good, you know, just a good relationship, you know what I mean? And it just started to spiral out of control. And I remember coming home, and one evening I came home. I was actually online doing courses, and came home, and there were like five detective cars parked outside, and a couple of cops came to the door and said, "We need to come into your house." And I said, "Well, what's going on?" Mm-hmm. And they said, "Well, we've heard of some inappropriate touching," they called it. It wasn't what they called a sexual thing. They said it was an inappropriate touch of some kind, which definitely didn't stand the reason or make any sense whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, you can come on in, you know, come
right,
on in.
Right.
Do what you want to do.
Have nothing to
look
hide.
Around. There's nothing in here that you're going to find."
Exactly.
And, you know, at that point, I'm still thinking, okay, you know, what, you know, you kind of put two and two together and kind of get an idea where this is coming from. And I contacted the mother. The mother was in complete shock. And what's ironic about this, when a person is plotting to do things on this level, the younger never went to a mother.
Oh, wow. Well, let me ask you something. So you say you got home and all the cars are there. Who called the? I mean, who called the cops?
The teenager who was plotting and doing and setting out to do these things went to the grandmother.
Ah.
And the grandmother, in return, ended up calling the police. And I told the mother, I said, "There's a reason she didn't come to you."
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Because we were aware of her behaviors and things
right.
that were going on. So
right.
that raised a big question mark. But again, it was not something I thought could happen. When they came in, they searched the house. And they said, and I'm thinking, okay, you got done. They said, "Well, you're going to have to leave the home right now."
Really?
And they removed me from the home. Ended up staying with a friend who lived in the same complex,
right,
unfortunately,
right.
me. And I think 3, maybe 4 months later, I was actually officially charged with what they said was sexual assault on a child by a person in a position of trust. Is the
right.
state reading of that?
Mm-hmm.
Which is horrific how the legislation is written in this state.
Exactly.
Because, you know, that sounds so horrific for what it is. And then going into prison with that label
yeah.
or that tag, your life is on the line on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
Right.
And,
yeah.
it was one of those things. And again, we went through the whole ordeal and did the things that brought some serious ramifications to my life and a lot of pain, and it'll blow your mind.
Right. Well, Amont, stay right there. We're going to just take this quick break, and when we come back, we want you to pick up right there. This is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. In the studio this evening, we have Lamont Banks for our exoneree moment. Thank you, Mr. Banks, for being here. We'll be right back after this.
Hi, I'm Mickey Palillo. I live in Bluefield, Virginia, and I'm a breast cancer survivor. 1 in 8 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer in their lifetime, and last October, I became one of those women. Thanks to early detection, I have a wonderful prognosis. I am now one of the 98% who will survive. Battling cancer is not easy, but early detection, support from family and friends, wonderful doctors, and continuing research make the journey much more bearable.
I'm a mother.
I'm a father.
I'm a sister.
A registered nurse.
I serve my country in the United States military.
I'm your neighbor.
I sit next to you at church.
And my child was arrested,
held in custody,
questioned without my knowledge,
exposed to violence,
witnessed to rape,
placed in solitary confinement,
unable to call or see me,
shackled to a wall,
beaten,
sentenced as an adult at age 17,
sentenced as an adult at age 16,
sentenced as an adult at age 15.
We felt lost,
isolated,
ostracized,
misjudged,
terrified,
and in the absence of all hope, my child took his own life.
And then I found the Alliance for Youth Justice.
They gave me the support and resources to get through one of the most difficult times in my life.
Now I know I'm not alone.
And neither are you.
Now we have a voice.
Now we have power.
In numbers.
In numbers.
In numbers.
We can make a difference.
There are approximately 2 million children in the juvenile and criminal justice system in this country. These are the faces of those families. If you are the family member of a child who has been in the justice system, or if you are someone who supports this movement and is ready to make a difference, visit the Campaign for Youth Justice at www.campaignforyouthjustice.org.
I can solve difficult problems for a Fortune 500 company.
I can run a successful business.
I can manage your home improvements.
I can publicize your message.
I can motivate your audience.
I can put my military experience to work for your company.
I can teach your children.
I can boost your bottom line.
I can add value to your workplace.
I could be a loyal and productive employee.
But I can't put my skills to work for your organization
if I'm not given the opportunity.
If you don't recognize my talents and ability.
If you don't hire me.
If you don't have an open mind and a workplace that's open to everyone.
If you don't realize that America works best when everybody works.
What can you do?
What can you do?
What can you do?
You can remember that it works.
It's what people can do.
It's what people can do that matters.
Nearly 50 million Americans have disabilities. Capitalize on their talents with employment practices that benefit everyone. Learn more at whatcanyoudocampaign.org.
This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast. I'm Sam Thurman, your host, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. If you'd like to call into the program, call at 347-205-9620. 347-205-9620. This evening in the studio, we have Lamont Banks for our exoneree moment. And he was just starting to share his story with us as to how his case just went totally wrong. And he was accused of a horrific crime. And, you know, the Innocence Project, Lamont, has listed several causes as to what can lead to a wrongful conviction. They talk about eyewitness misidentification, unvalid or invalid and improper forensic science, false confessions or admissions, government misconduct. You got bad informants or snitches, and then you got bad lawyers. And, you know, knowing a little bit about your case and reading your profile, there were a couple of things that where you can fit into these a couple of different categories here. So as far as the trial and things that led up to that, you know, share a little bit of that with us.
Well, they had basically come in, and once I was arrested, I was in county. I was able to make bond at that time, so I was actually.
And this was in El Paso County, Colorado Springs, Colorado.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay.
And we were able to bond out, and thought still, you know, this is going nowhere.
Right.
That's the mindset you have. There's no way this goes anywhere. And as it began to heat up, the initial thing from the police officer or the detective in the case made the statement to the grandmother, "We have nothing here."
Wow.
To go forward.
And the grandmother shared that with someone?
The grandmother shared it with the mother, and the mother in return shared it with me.
Right, right.
And said, "Well, this isn't going anywhere."
Right.
And I said, "Well, I never thought it would."
Yeah,
and,
right.
But things took a drastic turn. The district attorney, Donna Billick, here in El Paso County, began to pursue vehemently.
Let's say that name again.
Donna Billick.
Okay, thank you.
Donna Billick. And she began to pursue in a way that raises a question of the motivation that drives a prosecutor to cross the line of law.
Right,
it was from the very beginning.
Right.
Ironically, 3 months before we actually went to trial, I shared this a little bit the other night, the younger girl came to the mother and was crying to her and said to her, "Mom, I have something to tell you. My sister told me to continue to lie and to keep this lie coming. And she said, none of these things happen."
So the younger girl was actually a participant in the lie initially.
Initially.
Right.
And she couldn't hold it.
Right.
And when she went to her mother, she said, "Lamont never did anything."
Right.
And she said, "I don't want Lamont to get in trouble. Nothing happened." Mm-hmm. And my sister said if I didn't go along with her, that she would physically hurt me.
Right.
This girl was 8 years old at the time.
Wow.
Okay. It tells you the mindset. People say all the time, "Well, why would somebody make that up? Why would somebody do that? What world are you living in?"
Exactly.
Because it is as common as sliced bread in this country now.
Well, you know, Lamont, we've come to realize that nothing is a surprise anymore. You know, we talk about being naive to the system and being naive to the actions that people will do. You know, we were talking on the program about a week ago or so about this Judge Coker down in Texas.
Right.
And texting from the bench to a prosecutor, telling the prosecutor what to, you know, what questions to ask.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you talk about this, nothing is a surprise anymore.
Right. And you say even when the detective come back and says, "Hey, I find nothing. There's nothing going wrong." And then we've seen, just like in the IRP 6 case, the FBI says there's nothing here, civil matter. But then you have the DA and you have these U.S. attorneys that they continue, they say, "No, I'm going to find something. Yeah. I'm going to find something." Well, everybody is saying that no crime was here, that you're innocent, we haven't found anything. Then you have the people who, and that's what gets you, because the people who are supposed to be there to say, "I'm just a referee.
Exactly.
If you guys bring me some evidence, I'll go after it and ensure that no crime is further committed. But if you tell me there's nothing, I'm supposed to back off." But
exactly.
In your case, the DA says, "No, there's. I'm going to go after him," even though the detective – now, she's not a detective. She's an attorney. The detective says, "Hey, this is what I do. This is my job. I find nothing."
Mm-hmm.
Well, here's what's ironic about that is that when they presented this, the mother sent a letter directly to the judge and said, "We need to not pursue this. This is what's happened. This is what my daughter has told me." And at that point, it was ignored. It was never mentioned in the courtroom. The letter was never mentioned that the mother had written. Nothing was ever discussed about it. They pursued and went forward as if nothing was said.
Was the letter a matter of official record in the court?
Oh, absolutely. Anything turned over to a judge is of official record. It has to be logged and documented for.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and that's the point I wanted you to bring out.
Absolutely. And after that, again...
Well, let me ask you a question real quick on that. So in this situation, the judge... the letter was presented to the judge.
Correct.
So the judge just chose not to bring that up, or were there objections to block that being brought up?
Well, no, it was never
motions filed or something. I mean,
well, I'll tell you this: it was never done on the record. So there was no record to say, if something's done behind closed doors,
right?
You know, outside of the record,
exactly
off the record, it was never presented on the record.
Right.
So if something was said, we had no knowledge of it.
Right.
We were never made to it.
Man, Cliff and Ethel, I mean, when you look at even like with the IRP 6 and, mm-hmm. and the thing with Andrew Abarelli and him writing a letter to the U.S. Attorney's Office
right.
and well in advance identifying himself as a expert witness, and you get to trial and mm-hmm. Judge Arguello refuses to let him testify mm-hmm. under the auspice that, well, we didn't know that you were going to testify mm-hmm. as an expert witness. You know, that Lamont, when you bring this up, it's just, you know, it seems to be one of those things that just kind of people use certain avenues to their advantage. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about the judge, you know, in this situation, you got a county judge, I guess, or a state judge.
Correct.
And so, you know, it's one of those situations where they push the envelope, man, and they feel as though there are no checks and balances, and it's even worse mm-hmm. at the federal level. But go ahead, Lamont.
Well, I mean, and after that actually happened, we went ahead and pursued. My attorneys ended up talking to the younger girl, got it on tape, and recorded that it was a lie.
Yeah.
She testified to that fact. And actually, after that happened, Donna Billick made a statement to the younger girl and acts of intimidation to her. Well, that's not the answer I want to hear. So as she
really?
Began to pursue mm-hmm. and to say, hey, you know, what happened? And she kept saying, nothing happened. She said, that's not the answer I'm looking for.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're telling that to an 8-year-old girl.
Right.
But gratefully, and thank God, she was able to maintain her 8-year-old integrity, if you will.
Right, right.
To speak the truth. Mm-hmm. After that, my understanding was that there was a act, or you have an unspoken threat.
Right,
right.
That's there that if you think about to the older girl about changing your story.
Yeah.
Watch out. And my understanding was there were threats of jail threatened as well.
How old was the young lady who was
15.
Making act? Okay.
15.
Yeah.
And there were acts of threats made there.
So she was at the age where those were threats that she would be giving some serious consideration.
Consideration to.
Right.
And
yeah,
then,
she understands
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
And see, that is sick. You right. have mm-hmm. you have an eyewitness mm-hmm. and this 8-year-old girl that says, I've been lying. And I lied under a threat my older sister was going to hurt me.
Mm-hmm.
She tells this to the DA and says, well, you don't change your story, because if you change your story, then I'm going to prosecute you for lying about it in the first place. So you end up putting an innocent man in jail. It's like either
exactly.
either continue down your path of a lie mm-hmm. or I'll prosecute you for the lie in the first place. So mm-hmm. where does justice begin in this situation,
well,
any place at all? I mean,
yeah.
you have and it goes back to you get these rogue DAs
yeah.
and prosecutors that they go down their path and they're like, there's no way I brought the charges. There's no way I'm going back on them because my percentage of convictions
mm-hmm.
go down.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me look bad. Who cares about the innocent man that's going to
that's
work?
When
here's
it becomes a witch hunt, it seems.
Well, here's the ironic part about it. There was a district attorney in the office, a senior district attorney, who had been working for the prosecution, the DA's office, rather, for about 20 years.
Mm.
A friend of mine was a friend of hers.
Uh-huh.
And she made the statement to a friend of mine and said, you would not believe the stuff that is going on in El Paso County District Attorney's office. It was at such a level, even with this particular prosecutor,
right,
who by name
right.
was scheduled to meet the lady in lunch because there were so many questionable things about her behavior,
right,
about things that are consistent with this prosecutor.
Mm.
Do you know the lady, after working there 20 years, said she had to walk away and resign because she could not deal with the corruption that was present?
Wow.
Those are the words that were stated to me. So
yeah.
if you're dealing with that type of corruption,
mm-hmm.
and I'm telling you it happens more often than what we know about.
Yeah.
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 You know, it's a rare breed, I think, when you get district attorneys who go into office, because a lot of them at that level, you know, they're elected officials. Some of the underlings, I'll call it, you know, they mm-hmm. hirelings.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to look this one up. But there's I believe he's still in position in Texas, a district attorney who went into office, and he began to purposely look for cases like yours, Lamont,
mm-hmm.
and say, you know, well, this was a wrongful conviction.
Mm-hmm.
And he's purposely sought out. I think it's Harris County. We'll look that up.
Mm-hmm.
He purposely sought out cases where it was like, you know, this is wrongful.
Yeah.
And it was a wrongful conviction, should have never happened.
Mm-hmm.
And he's overturning stuff. And, you know, he made the news because of the fact that that's not what district attorneys are supposed
right,
to do.
Right.
Yeah,
well, if you're about the truth
and
about justice.
And about justice, that is exactly what
well,
you do.
I'll tell you this. The code of ethics for prosecutors and lawyers as a whole is that a prosecutor can zealously seek truth, not zealously seek a conviction.
Exactly.
And that's what they've done. They use their what they're allowed within that window, and they apparently were absent doing the code of ethics.
And that's what happened in the IRP6 case. It's the same thing.
Yes.
They zealously seek conviction.
Yeah.
What I did in this situation, as things persisted, it went as far as there was a cell phone recovered that had text messages from the older girl bragging, saying, "I told you nobody would believe him. I told you they would believe me."
Who were those messages to?
They were to, I guess, some friends of hers or people that she knew.
Mm-hmm.
And this gets a little bit more complicated because after the fact, the mother's on the phone. A friend who's in the military, who's a soldier, is on the phone. He testifies at trial, this one and the last one, and said he heard the young lady in the background saying, "Yeah, I lied, so what?
Oh, wow.
Nobody's going to do nothing about it."
Mm-mm-mm.
He testified to that in court, the first trial, and they still brought back the conviction.
Yeah, and Lamont, before we get too far down that road, for those who were not able to tune in on Tuesday night, you brought up a subject, an occurrence that happened during jury selection.
Yes.
You have got to share. That floored me.
Yeah.
I have never, ever heard of anything like that. And, well, share the story, and then I'll share my opinion.
Okay. We had come in for jury selection. A defendant is going to be there for the entire proceeding. He's entitled under the law to be there. So we're there for the whole day. It's jury selection, you have a pool of jurors. On that particular day, it was about 60 people. And when we got there, you know, the attorneys are introducing themselves to the jury, trying to get a feel for what they're about. And my attorney stood up and he said, "How many people before we get started today believe, because Mr. Banks is in the defendant chair, he has to be guilty of something or else he wouldn't be here?" Every hand went up in that courtroom.
That is amazing. And, you know, when you first shared that story the other night, I admitted it the other night. I didn't get it. I didn't get the point you were making. And then when we came back out of the break and you, recapped it, and I was like, wait a minute. This was the jury pool, 60 people. The defense attorney asked the question, "How many believe that Mr. Banks has to be guilty of something?" And everyone raised their hand. Mm. That sounds like that's enough to invalidate that jury pool to me.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's one of those things where how can you get a fair trial,
that's
Cliff?
That's right.
There's
no way. And you look at it, you say, okay, everybody believes I'm guilty. So my evidence is moot. The witnesses for me might as well not even show up.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
The whole system, whether it worked or not, is not going to do anything for me at this point. I have 60 people in a room who says the fact that I'm here and the DA brought the charges against me, I'm guilty. And that is the thing with these DAs. They don't. Well, they understand what they represent, and they understand how the public takes their actions, and they rely on that if I bring charges against this person and I say I'm going after an indictment for you, the general public is going to see you as guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And that is so sick, because just like with these people who said you got to be guilty of something, you have a witness says, "I heard this girl on the phone." You have her 8-year-old sister, "I've been lying because she's threatened me."
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the DA who persists and continues to say, I'm going to get a conviction. If I have to put everybody in here in jail with Mr. Banks, I don't care who lied.
Yep.
I'm getting a conviction.
Well, here's the problem you have with that is because the judge's role is to make sure that is not the case.
Exactly.
Right.
That is the purpose of the judge.
Exactly.
If the judge sits on the bench and you observe this,
right. Yeah.
You're privy to every bit of it.
And, you absolutely. Know, one of the things that I was thinking about as we were just talking here and as Cliff was sharing his comments, you know, it seems as though, and Lamont, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems as though that it's all about the convenience of the court. You know, well, we don't want to inconvenience the court. Mm-hmm. You know, we got a docket that we got to stick to. Mm-hmm. We're allocating X number of days to this case. We got to make it happen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you hear about some of the questioning when they're questioning mm-hmm. potential jurors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's like some of the questions are, you know, is there, you know, this in your life or is there something that you believe in or don't believe in mm-hmm. that could cloud your judgment or that could impact your ability to make an impartial decision in this case? Well, it sounds to me like 60 people had already answered that question that, yeah, because the man is sitting in the chair, I already believe that he had to have done something wrong. Okay, next group of 60 people
exactly.
come on in because it's
you
like,
know, exactly.
I just can't fathom how a judge would allow that to continue on.
Well, the problem is the whole jury pool process is really a joke. Because you can have a juror that you want. The prosecutor is going to get rid of every person
that is really qualified.
That's completely non-biased.
Exactly.
Get rid of them.
Yeah.
We don't want them. So they're picking people. Okay, we erase them. And here's the bad part. There are so-called jurors they can remove without challenge. They don't even have to give a reason, an explanation.
Really?
They're giving that. The defense is giving that, and the prosecution is giving that. So the defense can say, and you know this particular juror would probably do the right thing.
Right, right.
And you already sit in that chair, they'll never make it through it.
Wow.
Because the prosecution will get rid of them. So how can you possibly say, I am tried? The deception of the system is to say you're tried by people just like you.
So in essence, you're saying, okay, you're supposed to have a jury of your peers of 12
mm-hmm.
people.
Mm-hmm.
Me as the prosecution. Out of those 12, I automatically get a chance to say, well, two of those I'm just going to object to, and you cannot do anything about it.
Nothing about it.
And then the same thing on the other side, but still you end up with folks that are, I mean, and Lamont, I don't know, you know, if you've studied up or read up on the websites about Just Cause and the IRP6 situation. You had people sitting on that jury
mm-hmm.
that and not knocking anybody that works at Dairy Queen or at a grocery store or anything like
exactly.
that. But this case of the IRP6 was a technology case. It was a business startup case. You're talking about technology. You're talking about finance, business finance, staffing industry, and so forth. You got someone that worked at Dairy Queen who would, and that's a fact. The person that worked at Dairy Queen was on the jury, making $7 and something an hour.
Right.
And you're talking about technology people who are making $100 an hour. Number one, if you've never been there, that's going to be an astronomical number to you. And uh-huh. you're going to start thinking that, oh, yeah, just like, you know, you got 60 people raise their hand and say,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, he must have did something wrong. Well, you got the IRP6, five black gentlemen and one white guy,
mm-hmm.
and the majority of the jury is white. And you know, I'm not even going to go there as far as all mm-hmm. that goes, but the fact is, still, it is what it is. I mean, this is
absolutely.
America. The racial issue still exists.
Yes, it does.
You know, we get asked that question all the time. We don't readily go there.
Right.
But it is America.
Yeah.
And you know, and we have, you know, certain things have changed, but a lot of things have not.
A lot of things have
and
not.
You see it every day. And so, you know, you got people sitting there and it's like, oh, yeah, you got five black guys and you talking this kind of money. Oh, yeah, they probably did something wrong.
Well, we had a lady stand up, which was going to be a good potential juror, and she said, you know what? And the question to her was, would teenagers lie?
Absolutely.
And you know what she said? She stood up there, and she said, you know what? She said, I believe they would lie and never think twice about it.
That's right.
I'm a mother.
So true.
She said, I'm a mother. You know, guess what happened? She scratched. We don't want her on the jury. So any relates mm-hmm. to reality or truth, get rid of that.
And
because
it seems like the prosecutor goes after anything that looks like it would lean toward justice,
mm-hmm.
let's crush it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If and it, that's the system.
If it well, looks like this person might possibly think that with given evidence, well, there's a possibility he could be innocent. Get rid of that person. There's, we don't even want them. We don't even want their aura.
Well, what it tells
room.
You is it has left the foundation of what justice is.
Because exactly.
If it is about bringing people, look, give me 12 people. When you say a jury of my
peers.
Well, my peers for the IRP6 are those of technology.
Right, mm-hmm. exactly.
Those in that world. Mm-hmm. So anybody that's in that world of tech, of software and development and things along those lines, guess what? When they sit in that jury, they're going to be like, wait a minute.
Yeah, yeah.
This is not the case.
Exactly.
There's a possibility. So let's get, again, no disrespect to the McDonald's worker and the dairy
exactly.
worker.
Exactly. No,
but
no,
guess
no.
what? Can you relate to that?
Or right.
You
don't relate.
Or
you
don't say, hey,
don't.
They don't deserve me. They're making more money than me. I'm working hard and I'm not getting any money. Yeah, they probably did do it. It's a preconceived notion.
Yeah. It is. It is. And you know, and the thing is, too, is on the racial issue, that's even more of an atrocity, because we talked about it the other night from the standpoint that, you know, this type of stuff
mm-hmm.
has no color.
Oh, absolutely.
It has no party affiliation.
That's right.
It has no religious affiliation. This is a problem that's a systemic problem in our country that people need to stand up and fight, because, you know, we say it all the time. You know, folks look at it and they're kind of oblivious to it because it's not happening to them personally.
Right.
Mm-hmm. When in comes knocking on your door, then it's amazing how your eyes get open and it's like, oh, I did not know the system was like that. Well, welcome to
Absolutely.
This world.
Absolutely. And I was just thinking too, when he was talking about, you know, the 60 people in the room, certainly all of those people were not, there had to be some African-American people and other minorities that were there.
Very, very few. Maybe one.
Ethel,
maybe
we're talking
one.
El Paso,
you know,
County, Colorado Springs, Colorado.
Amazing. That is just, you know.
Yeah.
Wow. What do you say?
Well, I think the tragic part about all of it is that as you go through the process and you're sitting in that courtroom and the prosecution is able to say and to call you names. I remember she stood up and she said, Mr. Banks is a menace to society.
Mm.
Well, according to the law, I'm still presumed innocent.
And did the judge intercede at all?
He did not intercede on that because my attorney stepped up and said, Your Honor, what is this?
But if the judge did not intercede on all these people raising their hands to say that they believe this man was guilty, why in the world is this fool gonna intercede on something else?
That's right.
You know, you understand? It should never to the point where they had to question these people and, you know, asking them these different questions. They should have dumped all of them right then and there when they raised their hand.
Exactly.
Yeah. And,
exactly.
And the protocol of the system goes completely against that. If it was that easy and simple, it makes too much sense.
Yeah, it does.
Right.
It just makes too much sense.
It's too much like being right.
Justice
yeah.
is
yeah,
here.
It's too much like being
the
right.
The right thing is being here.
That's
And as we pursued, as we got through the trial, the lies that began to develop and to keep coming lie after lie. And I sat there at that table and I'm thinking, how are you saying these things?
Right.
How are you saying this?
Lamont, how long was this trial?
The first trial, I believe, lasted about 8 or 9 days.
Uh-huh.
And the second trial was about the same amount of time.
Mm.
And I remember one of the jurors asked the judge prior to the conviction, what is Mr. Banks going to get? See, the state of Colorado has what you call an indeterminate sentence, that no sex was involved here. The accusation didn't even involve that until later the lies started coming in the new trial.
Right.
But initially, no, nothing like that ever happened, no. And I remember on the pre-sentence report, it said, what do you want to happen to Mr. Banks?
And that was –
and
who was that?
That was
question
to the teenager that made the accusation.
Really?
So because they're allowed
so
to
So they're
in,
playing into her hand
playing
as far
right
as
into
her. I'm going to get rid of him.
But here's what happened, which didn't make any sense. I've talked to people who have been assaulted or abused as far as children. I've talked to people
in that
arena.
Right.
Her statement was, lock him up for about a year so he can think about what he did.
The 15-year-old.
Right. Now let me – about that, a victim who has been victimized,
right?
throw away the key.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Throw away the key because
exactly.
he doesn't deserve to live. He doesn't deserve to be out of prison. Because the reason that couldn't be the answer.
Right.
Because there was no violation.
Exactly.
You ceased to be a victim.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You're not a victim.
Man,
the victim in this case was me.
Yeah.
Exactly. Oh,
yeah.
Obviously.
Totally.
Absolutely.
Totally.
This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. Joining us in the studio tonight is Mr. Lamont Banks. He's our exoneree moment honoree. He's going to be with us throughout the remainder of the program talking about his experiences in the Colorado judicial system and some of the wrong that occurred there. Stay right there. We'll be right back.
I'm Chase Crawford.
Hey, what's up? It's Usher.
Hi, I'm Rachel Bilson.
I'm Hayden Christensen.
I'm Peyton Manning.
Hey, we're Fall Out Boy.
I'm Dude Archuleta.
I'm Corbin Blue.
I'm Kristen Bell.
And we're the Jonas Brothers.
Do something good for your community.
Reuse bags and bottles and always recycle.
Help us collect 1 million pounds of food.
Help people prepare for natural disasters.
Do something about homelessness.
Anyone could be a rock star in their community.
So then do something.
Do something.
Do something.
Do something.
Visit dosomething.org to find out how.
This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast. I'm Sam Thurman, your host, along with Cliff Stewart, my co-host, and Ethel Lopez. In the studio this evening, we have Lamont Banks. He's our exoneree moment honoree. Lamont, thanks for being here this evening.
Thank you.
Yeah, and, you know, Lamont, he was sharing his story about his going through the judicial process in Colorado, the accusations that were brought up against him, the court case that was brought against you, and the irresponsible district attorney. And one of the things, as far as, like we were talking a moment ago, as far as talking about the jury pool and how that selection went, I mean, that was just all crazy. Now, Lamont, before the time just totally gets away from us, you know, you have got to share with us some of the things related to, you know, your feelings about the lack of consequences when it comes to those who do commit these acts of misconduct. And then also, you know, the treatment that you received in prison and the health issues and all that kind of stuff. Folks, if you'd like to call in, call at 347-205-9620. 347-205-9620. This is a Just Cause Coast to Coast. Lamont, let's continue your story.
Well, as things pursued, and we'll go the prison situation at this point. The conviction came in the first case.
Right. And what was the sentence initially?
8 years to life.
That's crazy.
Eight
for something that you know that you did not
do. And the sad part about that, the indeterminate sentence primarily was a thought brought up by state legislators, not the Department of Corrections. It was done to say if you look at the history of the prison system, the indeterminate sentences was there to say if this guy is doing well, he's in prison, but he's a model prisoner, what he needs to do, he should be able to get out early.
Right.
He should be released. That is the actual definition of an indeterminate sentence. Mm-hmm. That was the purpose of that.
Okay.
In the state of Colorado, the Department of Corrections turned that into a life sentence for anybody sentenced to an indeterminate sentence. Person that has any type of case regarding what the state calls a sex case, quote unquote, you're sentenced to an indeterminate sentence, which means you can sentence me to 8 years. I'm eligible for parole at the end of eight. But
the possibility is there.
You can keep putting me back year after year and turn me down. I sailed with people, cellmates,
uh-huh,
that were sentenced to 7 years to life that had been down 15 years.
Wow.
Because I remember one of the ladies, she was a counselor at one of the facilities here in the state, and she said to me this, you better go ahead and make up your mind that you're going to be in prison the rest of your life. Because
a counselor said that.
This is what she said to me. She said, because Colorado's not putting these people back on the streets. She said, you people. And I said to her, I said, I'm not guilty.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I'm not guilty of anything. And I remember getting called in, and she said, she made a statement that, well, you better hope for the appeal, but Colorado just doesn't do that.
And, you know, Lamont, as I sit here and listen to this, you know, to me it sounds like, okay, you have a 15-year-old girl who orchestrates a sham,
yeah,
to get you accused, tried, and convicted of something that you did not do. And I would assume that when you would have come up for parole, this young lady could have gone before the parole board, and if she wanted to persist in carrying and keeping it alive, mm-hmm, unless she found a conscience somewhere,
yeah,
you know, she could show up, and you have a sympathetic parole board, and they're going to say, well, this young lady is still a victim.
Well, this is what they told me. They said, if you don't enroll in classes, that you need treatment, that you have a problem. When you come up for parole in these cases, they've put on your record that you are in denial, which means
if you don't want to
take the treatment. But here's the catch with that: the minute I agree to treatment, I am considered guilty.
Right, you're basically
because
saying,
it is,
man, yeah, I did.
Difference.
Here's, you're acknowledging
here's the big part about it. So I win the appeal. Say I win the appeal, but
right,
I somewhere along the way thought, man, I got to get out of prison, man. So
right.
I got to do this because I don't want to be here.
Right.
Well, guess what? I win the appeal. I come back for trial. The prosecution
says this.
Well, Mr. Banks admitted that he needed treatment.
Right.
Exactly.
Therefore, my new trial is of none effect.
Exactly.
Right.
Because that is used as a weapon.
Yeah.
But then they tell you, if you don't take the classes, you're going to rot in prison. I am grateful.
Right.
For how, on what level to the point to say, if you didn't do it,
right,
that's right,
you fight.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's it.
Exactly.
And I remember a day before I went to this new trial, they came back with an offer and said to tell Mr. Banks, if he doesn't want to go back to jail, we'll give him 20 years to life sexual offender probation.
Then you have to register as a
sex offender. Oh, and Mr. Banks, by the way, you won't have a computer in your house. We'll monitor what's on your TV.
Yeah.
And I said to my attorney, and she was so nervous, she said, I know you don't want to go back to prison. I said, tell them what they can do with that offer.
Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly.
Going to trial.
That's
Lamont,
right.
Let's go to the phones.
Yep.
Okay, on the phone we have Jeffrey. Jeffrey, are you there?
Absolutely.
All right. What's your question or your comment?
Well, I'm supposed to join the show tonight also as a guest. I'm an exoneree from New York.
Oh, are you? Oh, okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Jeffrey, tell us a little bit about your story.
Sure. I was accused at I was wrongfully accused at 16 in New York of a murder and rape. I was wrongfully convicted based upon a coerced false confession, which was given over the course of many hours of interrogation, prosecutorial misconduct, fraud by the medical examiner, and an inept public defender. I was convicted despite a negative DNA test, which showed that semen found on the victim didn't match. I lost all seven of my appeals. I was turned down for parole because I wouldn't admit, in part because I would not falsely admit guilt.
And you know, that sounds just like Mr. Banks was just stating, as far as, you know, if you agree to take certain classes, then you're setting yourself up to not get a favorable parole, and then if you don't take it, they hold that over your head. Is that sort of what you're talking about?
It's the same thing, you know. The particulars of that, it's exactly the same thing. The particulars of that in New York was they weren't satisfied simply with an admission of guilt to the instructor and to the other prisoners in the class, but then they wanted you to give details, and then they wanted it in writing. So even just saying, all right, I'm guilty, that wouldn't have been enough. They wanted things described, you know, to the T. You know, it would have been pretty disgusting to do that.
So, Jeffrey, obviously, as you stated, you are an exoneree. How long did you spend in prison?
I spent 16 years in prison.
Wow.
And
ultimately,
how old were you when you went?
I was 17 by the time the trial rolled around, and I lost. And I was 32 by the time I came out exonerated.
You've been exonerated, Jeffrey.
Yes. I got further DNA testing, which not only reaffirmed my innocence, right, because they knew that the DNA didn't match me before I was convicted, but it also identified the actual perpetrator. So for me to get cleared, I had to go beyond proving my own innocence. I ultimately had to prove the guilt of the actual perpetrator.
Wow. How long have you been out now, Jeffrey?
7 years.
Well, we'd like to say, you know, we are thankful that you were able to overcome those challenges.
Yes, absolutely.
And as so forth, were they very instrumental as far as that goes? I mean, I don't know. Did you have court appointed attorneys for the initial trial, and then you know?
I had a public defender. Go ahead. I'm sorry. You go ahead.
I said, who helped you as far as the appeal?
Well, I had state-appointed attorneys, which on the appellate level, I mean, my trial attorney was awful. I mean, he was a member of Legal Aid Society. I mean, ultimately, I wound up suing that agency, and they were forced to settle with me because they would have gotten, you know, killed at trial. My appellate attorneys were all good, but there the problem is what we encountered was that despite having really credible legal arguments and, you know, factual arguments as to my innocence based on the DNA, we ran into a problem which is typical in many wrongful conviction cases, which is that it's a rubber stamp appeal denial, you know, as the order of the day for amongst appellate judges. So ultimately my appeals were exhausted in 2011. So at that point, I just was by myself, and I decided I went on this massive letter-writing campaign, and ultimately I wound up with the help of the Innocence Project in New York, and they succeeded in allowing me to obtain further DNA testing from the DA without having to litigate over it, and I got lucky because the actual perpetrator struck again. He killed someone else 3.5 years later. He got caught for that. And that, as a result of his committing the second crime and getting caught, his DNA was in the database. So when we tested it, it came up a match. But for that, I would still be in prison right now.
And, Jeffrey, you do a lot of speaking engagements now, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, I've done over 100 across the country.
So, Jeffrey, yes, how can folks find out a little bit more information about you and your case? I want to point them to your website.
Yeah, absolutely. I have a couple of websites. First, I mean, you can Google my name, Jeffrey Deskovic, and more articles will come up than what you can read. And, you know, one of the links will be to my foundation, which I started, which is called the Jeffrey Desk Foundation for Justice. If I can digress for a brief second, the purpose of the organization is to clear other people who are still wrongfully convicted. See, I can't forget about the people that I metaphorically left behind. So I took a substantial portion of the money that I got by way of compensation, and I said, you know, I'm going to try to reach back. I want to continue the advocacy work I've done as an individual, speaking, lobbying, doing media interviews. I want to continue that. But I want to do a couple of things that I could never do on my own. I want to be able to help exonerate people, not simply in the DNA cases, but in non-DNA cases also.
No, finish your thought.
The other thing was, you know, I want to help people reintegrate. So, again, you know, you need a talented team. This is not a one-man show. So that's why I figured I needed to ramp this up a notch and start a foundation.
Excellent. Well, Jeffrey, thanks for calling in this evening. And, you know, we're going to hook up and have you on again where we can spend a little bit more time speaking with you about your situation and your foundation. Folks, that's Jeffrey Deskovich. Did I say that correctly, Jeffrey?
Yes, you did.
All right. I took a stab at it. And you can get more information about Jeffrey at www.jeffreydeskovichspeaks. That's JeffreyDeskovichspeak. www.jeffreydeskovichspeaks.org. Jeffrey, thanks for calling in this evening, and we will be back in touch with you. Folks, if you'd like to call into the program, you can call in at 347-205-9620, 347-205-9620. In the studio this evening, we have Lamont Banks, an exoneree out of Colorado, and we're focusing in on his case. Now, Lamont, we were talking about some of the things as far as the treatment that happens in prison. We were talking about that during one of the breaks. And I know that you have health issues as a result of your incarceration. And I know there are some things that you want to share about that. I mean, even like what Jeffrey was just stating, you know, there's some things as far as helping people and being an activist to correct some of these kind of things. And I know that you – are going to be doing some things later on. We're not going to get into all of that, but at least, sure. You know, let's share some of the things as far as some of the atrocities that occur in prison.
Well, I remember, you know, as far as solitary confinement, that's as common as common in prison and the treatment is horrific, without question. I remember I had the flu one night at the facility I was at. I was blacking out, very, very, very sick. I was very, very sick. And I remember falling into the door. They were opening the doors for chow. They'll pop all the doors, and you come out tier at a time.
Right.
And I remember I was so sick, I collapsed on the floor, and I hit the door. And the sergeant that was on duty said, lock the door back up, close the door. But I had, I knocked on the door. I said, man, I need to go over here and get some juice or something. I was dehydrated like you wouldn't believe. And he wouldn't open the door. Finally, he let everybody out, and my door opens. I said, thanks, man. I said, let me explain. He threw me against the wall, handcuffed me, and he said, you need to shut your mouth.
Really?
And at that point, I'm so sick. You know what I mean? I don't have any energy.
So do they think you're faking or something?
It was just, again, it's
or
the,
just
it's,
the,
it's
show
just
the show of intimidation and force.
And I remember when I got ready to walk, I was somewhat falling a little bit because, I was really. And he makes a statement to me, and he says, don't pull away from me. Like he wants to use force on me.
Right.
And I said, I'm not pulling away from you.
Right.
I said, don't go there with me, man. I'm not even doing nothing.
I'm not
doing anything.
Right.
Number one, I'm sick enough to die right now. He says, well, you're going to the hole. And I remember they took me to the captain's office, and the captain came out and said, well, what's going on? It's all fronting. It's nothing of it is reality. They're not going to believe anything you say. I got in there, and I said, let me explain what happened. She goes to the back, talks to this sergeant by himself. Cellmate said, Captain, Mr. Banks didn't do anything.
Right.
He's been sick, laid up for 3 or 4 days. He didn't do nothing. She said, you need to leave the office.
This was to your Sally?
Yeah. Uh-huh. So he leaves the office, and she says, Lamont, you're going to go ahead and go to the hole, and we'll gather your things. When you go to the hole, they take all of your TV, your appliances, everything that you have,
right.
The little comforts that you have in that moment.
Right.
And I was so upset. I said, you can go ahead and cuff me up. I said, because you're not going to listen to nothing that I say.
Right, right.
Well, ironically, when I got to the hole, the guards, they had about four or five guards there that see you come in there going to the hole. I'm in a jumpsuit. And they say, well, you're going to have to take your clothes off. But they refuse to unchain me. So I'm here trying to get...
How do you take your clothes off with chains on?
Well, I said to him, how am I supposed to do that? But those are acts of humiliation.
Exactly.
Is what they are.
Yeah.
And when I took my clothes off, and you got the guards just looking at you, they got their gloves on, and you are... It doesn't get lower than that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I remember taking the clothes, and I said, can you please take this off, man? He said, we can't do it. This is policy. This is protocol. Well, you got six guards around me.
Like, what are you going to do?
I'm handcuffed. Where am I going?
Exactly.
And you're sick with the flu, can't even stand up.
So I went to the hole. They put me in a cell.
Now, you were in the hole naked?
No, because after that, they let me put my jumpsuit back up. They had to basically search me or whatever that they did.
Right.
Then they take you to a room, and they give you a pair of boxers that you came down in a bag, and you put those on. I remember that day, and it was very, very cold in there, and they wouldn't shut the windows. And I said, man, it's really, really cold in here. I'm really sick. And he said, we'll get your bedding down here in a minute. I waited for probably, it had to be at least 12 hours. It was about 4 or 5 in the morning before I got any covers. And I kept calling guards. I said, will you please get me my stuff? And I remember I said to him, I said, man, I need my Bible. I said, give me my Bible. At least give me that. You don't need your Bible, they said to me. You don't need that.
You know, Lamont, we talk about it from time to time that people acts. They should be subjected to the same thing. You are an innocent man. You are now a free man.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone from the judge to the prosecutor to guards that are in the system who mistreated you, mm-hmm. who were instrumental in ensuring that you went to prison, and then the things that the way they treated you in an inhumane way while you were in prison, those people should be subjected to the same thing. Because it would open their eyes to the fact that everybody that walks through this door or through this fence,
right.
is not thing that says something to the effect that, you know, it's better that, 10 guilty men go free than to incarcerate one innocent man.
And the thing, too, is with it, it's even for the people who are guilty. Why would you treat them?
Exactly.
Why would you treat them so
you've taken
inhumane.
Their freedom away.
And what more do they have? I mean, it's your freedom.
Yeah,
you know?
then they start to mess with your dignity just as a human being. Mm. It's like you've been locked up, then they shackle you and then strip you. Say, well, you're going to have to get stripped to go to the hole.
Point.
Yeah, it's like so now you're humiliating me on top of everything else. And I'm sick, and then you bring down your own sense of punishment by leaving me in an ice cold room with the windows open, no bedding, nothing. And when you try to get some type of comfort, like give me my Bible, the thing that, you know, I was raised to believe in, I was raised to understand that when there's nothing else there, I have the comfort of the Word of
exactly.
God.
Exactly.
That is the only thing. When everything else fails, you know that that's what you have to hold on to.
Yeah.
And they tell you, you don't need.
Hope they take away every single thing, your dignity, every single thing that you even think you have. They're taking it away. Mm-hmm. And then with you already having the flu and being sick, what kind of crap is that with the windows open and it's cold and everything? I think that's attempted murder. Jesus, what kind of crap is that?
Well, and you know, Lamont actually made a comment to that effect on Tuesday night. And then actually last week, Anthony Graves made a comment along that same line that, you know, not only are you an innocent man that's been convicted,
mm-hmm.
but then once you start your prison sentence, then they began. I remember specifically that Mr. Graves said that. He said, then they started trying to kill me, man.
That's it.
It's like, yeah. and in his situation, being put on death row, they were definitely trying to kill him.
Oh, yeah.
But who's going to prosecute them for all the things that they did wrong? And then you have the guards that, I mean, they're beyond immune because they're behind closed doors. They can make up these things like, don't pull away from me. It's like, I'm not doing anything. I have no energy. I have no strength to pull away from you. You know, we had talked to David Banks, one of the IRP6 one time, and he said a guard came to him like, you know, putting him up against a wall and then making this loud noise. Mm-hmm. Oh, what are you doing with a cell phone? And then so that now I have something to mistreat you about. Now I can throw you up against the wall. I can frisk you. I can strip search you and all these things because he made it up. And who is there to say keep these guards at bay and ensure that they that they follow the rules that they're supposed to follow?
Well, there was a lady guard that came through. It was about 3 a.m. and I remember I couldn't sleep and I'm sitting up on that concrete bed and she said, I'm going to tell you something. She said, there's not a guard in this facility that doesn't know who you are. She said, the harder you push, the harder they're going to push back. Her words to me was this. If you are willing to fight, you better know what you're in for because there's a mark on your back. This is what she told me when I was raised insane. I said, I have no business down here in the hole. And shortly after she was gone, I never saw her again. I don't know what happened or what occurred with that. And to me, and this
sounds like you got a group of people who are insecure.
Well,
they're power tripping.
Well, the worst to me was this. This is, we don't do what the Department of Correction says. She said, this is the Department of Buena Vista. Mm. We do what we want to do.
And that seems to be systematic because we hear the same thing out of Florence. You know, this fool Griggs, the camp administrator, he's down there, he's doing things and then say, this is my camp, I'm running this.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It's like, well, what about what the Department of Corrections says? Make these bold, brash statements that this is my house. You do what I say when you're here.
Well, and you remember, Cliff, once we were down there on a Saturday visiting. And people, I mean, you're in the visit center. People are there to visit, and they, you know, are embracing and, you know, shaking hands and sitting down and talking and everything else. Some people, you know, standing at one place or another. And the camp administrator, Griggs, walks in, and he screams and says, hey, shut up, sit down. You think this is some kind of
social
out? That is exactly what it is.
You dumb idiot.
And, you know, a Just Cause filed a complaint against him on that.
Sure.
And you know, those are the kind of things where, you know, like you were just talking earlier, they try and strip you of everything that you have anyway. Then when you do have family that comes and support you, you know, it's like then you're going to try and strip that as well?
But I'll tell you this. The Department of Corrections for the state of Colorado, at least from what my viewpoint is, they're a front.
Yeah.
They don't challenge these prisons in most cases. They
right.
let these prisons do whatever they want to
right.
do. Because I was at 6 of my time. So I've seen it all.
That's like
all
a move
prisons.
Every
I'm
year.
I'm telling you.
And I said to them, I said, why are they moving me? We don't want you getting too comfortable where you're at.
Wow.
Okay. Well,
they don't have to worry about you getting comfortable.
Is anybody in there comfortable?
Well, the problem you have is that when you move it's a psychological assault is what it is.
Right.
Because it's like moving to a new city.
Exactly.
Right? Now you have to get accustomed to people. I remember one guard said to me one day, he was really mad. I was in the hole and I was refusing to come out of the hole. And he said to me, why don't you tell Mr. Banks?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the protocol in prison, you don't discuss your case.
Right.
Period.
Right.
You don't discuss that.
Right.
Especially a case in the magnitude that I was sent
exactly.
for. You can get a man killed that way.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So then people are coming and asking questions. You have if had it not been for probably the grace of God for me.
Right.
You don't survive.
Right.
you don't survive. So something has to be done.
Yeah.
You know,
something has to be done.
Looking here at the mission statement for the Bureau of Prisons. And it says here, it is the mission of the Federal Bureau of Prisons to protect society by confining offenders in the controlled environment of prisons and community-based facilities that are safe, humane, cost-efficient,
right,
and appropriately secure, and that provide work and other self-improvement opportunities to assist offenders in becoming law-abiding citizens. That's the biggest bunch of crap I've ever heard.
And you know what, though, Ethel, is that even is the situation that Lamont is describing at the state level, you know, it sounds like you got a bunch of boss hogs running around. If anybody remembers that old show, you know, Dukes of Hazzard, and you got, you know, a bunch of sheriff wannabes and folks who are running their own little domain.
Absolutely.
It's their world.
Yeah, it is.
Right. It's a power thing. And I remember, I'm going to tell you, one of the loneliest rides is leaving county jail headed to the Department of Corrections. You will find no road that is darker. I remember going to the to DRDC, they're the processing center. When you get there, I can't tell you the feeling of a person that knows they're not guilty. You're locked down 23 hours a day in that facility. You get up, you go to chow, you come back. You're locked down, you may get 15, 20 minutes to take a shower, and you're back in that room. So I remember when I first got there, I remember looking in that big cell, and I was by myself initially, and to touch.
Right.
And I remember facing that wall, and I said, I've made mistakes in my life, but God, this is something I didn't do.
Right.
And I remember saying, please don't leave me here. Mm. Please.
Yeah.
And I remember that moment as I relive and retrace my steps of that journey.
And you're reliving it right now. Yeah, I can see it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You. So when I think about my brother,
mm-hmm,
David Banks,
one of the IRP six.
When I think about Clinton, these are people I've known my whole life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I am appalled that we call this country America of the free.
Right.
It is a joke. It is a disgrace.
Mm-hmm.
It is a dishonor.
Yeah.
And if somebody doesn't stand up, if the people that listen tonight don't understand this is serious business.
That's right.
That is somebody's mother, that is somebody's father, that is somebody's brother, that's their sister, behind that cold door.
Yeah.
When do we stand up and say it's enough? Yeah. When do we say, you know what, we're not going to shut up until something happens?
Yeah.
And you know, Lamont, I wish that could all be here in the studio right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is a man that is speaking from his heart.
Yeah.
And I think you can sense that even through the airways. But, you know, you talk about your brother, David Banks, and then you also have a sister that was subjected to, you know, wrongful conviction.
Yeah.
You good?
I remember that situation.
Do you need to take a break, Mark?
No, we're good.
Okay.
Right. I remember that situation. My sisters, whether they're older than me or not, are like my little sisters because I'm the guy, they're the girls.
Right.
That's just when I heard that, I thought about what they did to me. My sister,
who never did anything.
She never done nothing. She's in chains because a judge
exactly
decided that I'm going to do what I want to do and forget the laws that are supposed to govern us.
And forget the evidence that's sitting on the table that proves innocence.
How do you sleep at night?
Exactly. And, you know, Lamont, we're going to have your sister on next week, and as well as a forensic handwriting expert.
Mm-hmm.
She did the analysis in your sister's case to prove that she did nothing wrong.
And presented the evidence to the judge, says, I do forensics handwriting analysis for the FBI, for the federal government for over 20 years. I checked this evidence that you guys say that you have against her. I looked at the handwriting. There is no way that LaJuana, that this is her handwriting. There's no way she did.
And you know, Lamont, and you know, you were talking about the way that you were raised, and you know, you who was wrongly accused, wrongly convicted, incarcerated for 6 years, and you're out now, and I know that you're going to make a change because I know how you were raised. Your brother David Banks, I know the impact that – well, he's making an impact even right now, even though he's been wrongly incarcerated for 14 months right now, along with the other of the IRP6, Gary Walker, Kendrick Barnes, Dave Zappolo, Clint Stewart, and Demetrius Harper. Mm-hmm. You know, and I know that David is making an impact, and he's going to make an impact.
Yeah.
Your sister, LaJuana Clark. And like you said, you know, never did anything. I mean, LaJuana is the type of person that will give another person the last dime in her purse. Mm. And, you know, knowing your mother and she's not, you know, we're not going to expose everything on the air, but mm-hmm. your mother is not going to take this sitting down.
No.
And, you know, she is actively involved in the fight.
Sure.
Because this is one of those things where you can't just sit by and watch this, and she motivates others to get involved.
Absolutely.
Motivates others to get involved.
Yeah.
But Lamont, you know, go ahead and go a little bit further into your story. I mean, we're gonna skip the rest of the breaks and just continue to get this story out there.
I remember going through that at the diagnostic center. I remember pulling up. The first prison that I arrived at was at Sterling, which is one of the largest prisons, state prisons here in the state. I believe the largest, 2,500 inmates. They had a reputation of very, very bad things that happened there, and I saw a lot of things that are with me today. They'll be with me till I die. The things that I saw.
Yeah.
I remember when I pulled up in that bus. How cold. Cement, you got cement walls. There's no looking out and seeing a tree.
Right.
Or a flower.
Right.
You see cement walls all around you. The only thing you can do is look up and see the sky. That's it.
Right.
There's nothing else you're going to see. I believe primarily that we have to be the voices of those that cannot speak for themselves. And those that are incarcerated do not have a voice.
That's right.
Period. When I tried to talk, I was shot down.
Yeah.
I was laughed at. I was mocked. I was ridiculed. I remember one of the counselors said to me, "You need to be enrolled in some classes, Mr. Banks." I said, "Well, we're hoping for the appeal." Mm-hmm. I said, "There are no classes because there's no problem here."
Exactly.
And he looked up at the lieutenant and snickered. He didn't know I saw him. And I made a point that when my attorney sent the word that the case had been overturned and my conviction was
so you remember out. The names of these people.
Absolutely.
Excellent.
Absolutely. And I looked at him and I said, make sure he gets this kite.
Mm-hmm.
My day out.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, my case was overturned.
Awesome.
I'm not guilty.
That's right.
That's right.
So while you're laughing in your office,
that's right.
Sitting back, guess what? I'm free. I'm going home.
That's right.
And I'm thankful to God for
Thank
that.
God.
So,
amen. That's right.
Look, you got to fight. This is a fight. This is a battle because the problem is so big. It comes. It does not come without war.
And you know, Lamont, you know, let's touch a little bit on the gross diet that is fed to the to the inmates. You know, on the Tuesday evening show, you talk about the old, and you almost died earlier this year as a result of your. Health issues that came up as a result of prison.
Well, the food in there is nothing healthy in the Department of Corrections, period.
Right.
The food on some of the boxes even say not fit for human consumption.
And we've heard that before.
Yes, we have.
That's actually written on the boxes in some of the foods and things that they have. So my thing is this, when we complain about it, and you got inmates throwing up leaving the chow hall, and you got the inmates that are sick, and you want to get an attitude
about
you're feeding. You guys are in prison. Is this a communist country? I got news for you. Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
Because what you have here now is you have primarily people sick. Mm-hmm. When you make a complaint about it, guess what? They're going to do one of two things. They're going to tell you, don't worry about it, get over it, or we're going to take you to the hole and say you're pending an investigation right now. So I think primarily what happens is, I remember going to the hole on several occasions. I said, why am I going to the hole? And the statement was made to me, oh, you're pending an investigation. We're looking into some things here. We felt we needed to remove you from population.
They put you in the hole, mm-hmm. and you're already in bad condition. They put you in dire straits by putting you in the hole and saying, oh, it's for your sake.
And that's just for sending a kite to say, hey, can we get some fresh milk for breakfast?
Right.
Can we get the chicken cooked that it's not bleeding like a steak in the tray?
Mm.
Can we get that?
Raw chicken.
Yeah. And I said, this is bloody. You take it to the counter, they throw it back at you. We eat it. It's fine. It's cooked. Really? And then you wonder why the condition of men, women everywhere in these prisons are what they are. The mental breakdown that goes on in the hearts and in the minds. Nobody is speaking out against it. And I remember a friend of mine from the penitentiary sent me a letter a couple of weeks ago, and he made this statement to me. He said, I thought you should know that the diabetic menu that was on the menu in the prisons has been eliminated.
Mm.
And the diabetics are told, eat what you can off the trays that we give you.
What?
Now, in my case, as you alluded to earlier, I almost died 9 months ago. I developed, according to my doctor, diabetes as a result of the diet over several years of incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
They found me in my apartment with my sugar level at 1,400.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if anybody knows anything about diabetes, I'm supposed to be dead at about 600.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mine was at 1,400.
And you went into a coma.
I went into a diabetic coma.
Right.
From what the doctors told me, my pancreas shut down. And my doctor said this to me out of her mouth. This is from the lack of care that you received while you were in prison. That's exactly what she said.
Now, they didn't really give you much of a chance to live. Exactly.
They never even diagnosed me. They took blood from me. When I told them I wasn't feeling good and black. Here.
No, I mean when you were found earlier this year after you were released,
absolutely.
And the doctors in the hospital didn't give you much of a chance of survival.
There was hardly no chance of survival.
And it seems, you know, that this is a systematic problem because, you know, I was reading a report. They had done an investigation at another prison at Corcoran down in California, and they said they observed the medical staff reportedly failing to wash their hands before treating patients. The medical staff and equipment were stored in non-sanitary conditions. Medical leadership failed to conduct oversight and review of clinicians. A particular concern to the investigators was a high number of bacterial infections inmates contract while in the prison's licensed acute care hospital caused from unsanitary intravenous lines, which can lead to sepsis and potentially death. And the worst part about this is they say the Department of Corrections declined to comment on this report. You
That's
have people
ridiculous.
That are about to die.
Yeah.
They're going through all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You were in the hospital. I came to the hospital and saw you.
Mm-hmm.
And you're talking about out of it, gone, not cognizant. And the doctor says he's got a 50-50 chance. And when you woke up, the doctor...
What do you think is going to happen in prison at this particular prison?
They don't even have care.
At this particular prison, I shared with you earlier that prairie dogs with infection diseases were actually getting in through the vents. When we went to the officers and complained, they said there's nothing we can do about it. These prairie dogs are in the beds with inmates, biting them. What? And you're telling us there's nothing you
can do. There's nothing you
can
do about rodents coming in.
Lamont, we want to thank you for joining us this evening on A Just Cause and sharing your story. We're going to have you back.
Okay.
And like we said, we're going to have your sister on next week and talk about the case there. And this is A Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring you education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. You can join us each Thursday evening right here at 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And we'd like to, again, if you'd like to reach us and find out more information about Lamont Banks, we're going to have the archives of this program at www.a-justcause.com. And for more information about the IRP6, go to www.freetheirp6.org. And Ethel, let's just point them to the website for Eric Holder's number. They can get that number.
Holder's number. 02-514-2003. 202-514-2003.
Join in on the campaign to get Eric Holder to join in on that fight against the injustice that's going on with the IRP6 Cliff.
All right. We want to say thank you to our production crew, K&D Productions, our engineers, Il Skillo's girl in the back room, taking care of everything. Also want to shout out to the AJC Radio Coast to Coast production support team for their research effort and for helping us with everything we need. Also, to the truth, we know you're out there, that you're for us, you're always with us, and for that.
Follow us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. The number is 855-529-4252, 855-529-4252. You can reach a Just Cause during the week. Jeffrey Deskovich, thanks for calling in. You're tuned to a Just Cause Coast to Coast. Tune in next week. Have a great weekend.
Good night,
America.
Good night, wherever you are.